From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our series on agriculture in Wisconsin continues with a lesson on dairy economics.
It does not take a very large change in milk production, change in exports, or demand result into $1, $2, $3, $4 change in the milk price.
Later, our correspondent on the Appalachian Trail talks about her ways to relieve the monotony of hiking every day.
Holding on to the milestones of, oh, we hit 1,000 miles. Oh, we hit halfway. Oh, we hit 100 days on the trail, which we recently hit. So these are all ways to just mentally feel really encouraged to keep going.
And we listen back to our 2009 interview with Martin Landau. The actor died this weekend at age 89.
What a character says to another character is what he's wishing to reveal or share with another character. Then the 90% he isn't willing to is what I do for a living.
Lake Effect comes your way next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This summer, we've been looking at agriculture in southeastern Wisconsin as part of our Full Plate series. And it may come as no surprise that much of our agriculture here is wrapped up in dairy. After all, we are the dairy state. But despite the moniker, Wisconsin is not immune to the market forces that drive the price of dairy both here and throughout the country.
You might notice when you go to the grocery store that the price of milk varies a lot. In fact, it changes so much that it's routine for some groceries and delis to post the price outside of the store, like signs at a gas station.
So what makes the price of milk so variable, and what does that volatility mean for the dairy state? Lake Effect's Joy Power spoke with dairy economist Bob Kropp about the different factors that go into deciding the price of dairy products.
I can boil them down to three major factors, really. Of course, one is the level of milk production, how much milk we're producing, and the second would be demand, our domestic demand, how our cheese is selling, butter, fluid milk is selling, how many dairy products are selling, and a third one, which is relatively new, I say new, started about 10, 12 years ago, is exports of dairy products. We used to export some dairy products, but usually what we were doing is government subsidizing exports to get rid of excess surplus milk. But now it's a real part of our demand situation, and so we are exporting 14 to 15% of our milk supply. So whether exports go up or down is a big factor on milk prices. They were weaker last year, so we had lower milk prices. They're picking up now, and so we're seeing a little stronger milk prices. So I say the three things: production, demand, and exports.
And exports. What happened about 10 years ago that changed that, that made exports a much bigger part of the U.S. dairy market?
Part of it's tied to our federal dairy policy. From 1950 up to the mid-1990s, the federal government supported farm milk prices at a relatively high level at times. And particularly the late 70s, early 80s, it was a level that encouraged farmers to produce a lot of milk. We had surplus milk. In about 1980, 81, the government was buying 10, 12% of all the milk. They're buying up butter, cheese, non-fat dry milk off the market to hold the price up to farmers. And that was accumulating. So to get rid of it, they went for Food for Peace. Different programs like that would subsidize and get it on the market. That program changed, and so from the mid-1990s on now, we do not support the milk prices at that level. So market forces drive our milk prices now rather than the government program. And the industry gradually got involved, the dairy companies, cooperatives, and private companies, to start looking at the international market. So they have grown developing products and become more active in trade. And, of course, we have also established a U.S. Dairy Export Council, which helps the industry seek out international markets. The government has trade assistance programs as well. So now many companies look at the international market as part of their real market rather than just trying to get rid of some surplus dairy products.
You mentioned inside of that in the 90s, the federal subsidies really ended. One thing that when I was talking to people about dairy prices in general that seemed to keep coming up was how volatile the prices sometimes seem for specifically milk. Why do dairy prices seem to change so much from week to week and sometimes even from day to day, it seems?
Well, it's driven, I say, by market forces. We do have a substantial change in milk prices month to month, you said, year to year, since the 1990s, since the government got out of the program. And a lot of price volatility and uncertainty that farmers have to deal with. And it's kind of tough on farmers at times because we've seen some awful low milk prices in recent years. Even last year, prices were not very good, especially the first half of the year. So milk is very sensitive to relatively small changes. I mean, it's a perishable product. Farmers got to milk the cows every day. It's got to go to the market. And milk we drink goes through real fast. You keep cheese and butter a little longer. But you can't store it like corn or wheat or something to wait for better prices. And demand is relatively inelastic, and consumers don't respond greatly to price changes. So it does not take a very large change in milk production, change in exports, or demand to result into $1, $2, $3, $4 change in the milk price. It's hard for farmers to understand that, but it's basically a highly perishable product that's got to move through the marketing system fairly quickly, and a little bit too much, prices are down, a little bit shortage, and prices go up. So a great deal of price volatility. And we started in the mid-90s developing futures markets where you farmers in industry could hedge their cheese, butter on the futures market or milk. Class 3 futures, for example, price risk management tool to deal with that. We didn't have that prior to that because the government provided the price stability. So it doesn't take big change. And there's some psychology in the market, too. We think that, like the cheese market, if they think that cheese is building and it may go lower, buyers come real soft and only buy as they need. So that kind of lessens demand. The price may go down, or the opposite of things, the prices go up, they buy ahead and drive a little higher. So, but through time, it's the market forces, the supply and demand situation that is going to drive those prices. But you have times, for example, this is last week, the price of cheese, which is good news, has increased quite a bit the last couple of days. And evidently the buyers are thinking that, well, we're moving to summer, it's getting hot. Here about California, it's very hot out there. Some cows even dying out there. California's a big milk-producing state. Maybe the supply and demand is going to get tighter in cheese, and maybe I ought to buy ahead a little bit. So the market has gone up the last few days.
So right now, to that point, what does supply really look like? What are we getting from specifically Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, we had a very strong increase in milk production last year. We went up about 3.5%. That's a lot of milk. In fact, we had 30 billion pounds of milk, and we were down to 22 billion pounds of milk back in 2004. The industry has been growing. And of course, you had stories. We ran out of plant capacity due to some Canada stopped buying some ultra-filter milk from us. So right now, it's slowed. I mean, we're growing, so far this year, we're growing less than 1%, which is still a fair amount of milk. But last year, everything was ideal. The weather was ideal. Feed quality was ideal. Cow's milk, very good. What's more important, well, Wisconsin is important what they do because we're the second largest milk producing state. And what California, number one, does has a big impact on the market. But nationwide, we're growing about 2% over a year ago, and that's quite a bit of milk. And we can withstand 1% or so growth in milk production and keep farm prices fairly decent based on domestic demand. But if we get over that, we need that export market to market some of that product. And we're seeing right now our exports picking up, and that's good news.
But as you mentioned, Canada stopped buying some kinds of milk for a bit. This was something that came up with even the president. It's something that made national headlines. What was that situation? Because it wasn't quite clear for a lot of people.
Well, we had a trade agreement several years ago with Canada. And at that time, milk protein, ultra-filtered milk protein, bounty, where we take some of the water out of milk, maintain basically the protein in that milk, and that's good for cheese making. And because the protein in milk, it will, as the butter fat, determines cheese yield. If you take a lot of the water out, it improves the efficiency of cheese baking. You don't have all the whey and stuff that comes out of there. Well, that product didn't exist at that time, so it was not part of the trade agreement with Canada. Canada has a very protective market. They support milk prices of farmers at a relatively high level through a quota system that controls their production. And it's well above world market prices, so they need to have import protection because their prices are so high. Well, it wasn't under there. And also, with the production control in Canada, milk production does not grow in Canada. And there were cheesemakers up there wanted more milk to supply the market, not only in Canada, but the world market's growing. And so they were buying this ultra-filtered milk from Wisconsin, mainly Wisconsin and New York, two states where there were companies. We had Grassland in Wisconsin that really geared up and supplied that market. It amounted to about 1 million pounds of milk a day if go to that market, quite a bit of milk. But anyway, the government said, you know, we just soon have our cheese plants use our milk. Rather than bringing this milk in from Wisconsin, even though the cheesemakers really liked it because it was a good way to make cheese. So they changed the pricing system up there in Canada so that the milk in Canada, they created another class, Class 7. Milk in Canada is now just as cheaper than bringing it in, so it doesn't pay to buy from us anymore.
How did that dispute and really the outcome there, how did that impact dairy prices here and really the market conditions?
It was devastating for those farmers that lost their market. They have, unfortunately, others picked it up, but maybe at a lower price, what have you, than they were getting originally from grassland. But the overall price was not impacted that much. Since prices are driven on a national scene, more so than this what goes on in Wisconsin, it was not a big impact on the price.
So the Trump administration is mulling over some tariffs. As a kind of a response to that, officials in Europe and around the world have threatened their own tariffs. And one of the things that's been brought up is dairy, tariffs on dairy exports. Is that something that you've heard about? Is that something that you're concerned about?
Well, yes. I mean, as I said, that if we're going to continue to grow the dairy industry, and not only Wisconsin, the U.S., our domestic demand is growing slowly. Fortunately, we eat more cheese every year. That's a bright spot, yogurt. But we can withstand about 1% growth or so. So we need an international market. And we're, you know, been involved in trade negotiation with the European Union and others. In fact, there was a trade agreement that President Trump said we'd not be involved with, which would involve several countries. European countries, but Japan and New Zealand and Canada and others, we need to be involved in those trade negotiations so we have favorable trade, fair trade, and some countries are very protective of their markets. We're trying to break those down to expand trade. So our two largest markets are Mexico and Canada. And there's a lot of talk about NAFTA, which was a trade agreement several years ago between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And that has removed the tariffs on products from U.S. to Mexico, for example. And they by far are our largest market, particularly for non-fat dry milks, skim milk powder. And so trade is extremely important, and the trade negotiations will have future ones working out with it. European Union just developed a new trade agreement with Japan. And that concerns us a little bit because Japan is an important market for us. And so if they have more favorable trade there, we may not have as much export from the U.S. to Japan that impacts us. So we're concerned about, you know, our trade negotiations and what other countries are developing in trade negotiations.
There's been conversation, you mentioned NAFTA, there's been conversation about renegotiating NAFTA or even, you know, removing it and then finding a new kind of trade agreement. If NAFTA suddenly went away, what would that mean for dairy farmers?
Well, if we done away with NAFTA and removed our ability to export like we are now to, say, Mexico, that would be quite devastating. That is by far our largest market. that actually Mexico and Canada have been accounting for about 30-40% of our total dairy trade. So if somehow they retaliate it, stop buying from us, whatever, you take that amount of exports away from us, we would see the price of milk drop substantially.
Well, Robert Kropp, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Okay, thank you.
Bob Kropp is a professor emeritus and dairy marketing policy specialist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. For a forecast of the U.S. dairy market, you can head to WUWM.com for a web exclusive with Kropp.
A short break now, and then we'll check back in with our contributor on the Appalachian Trail. Lauren Groh is halfway from Georgia to Maine, and we'll hear what the halfway point means to her next on Lake Effect. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. We've been checking in periodically this summer with Milwaukeean Lauren Groh, who's through hiking the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine.
When we last spoke with her, Groh was making her way through Virginia, which represents a substantial portion of the trip. But as she checks in with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, Groh has hit both the literal and spiritual halfway point on her trek, Harpers Ferry, West Virginia.
It's a really cool town. It's a Civil War town, and there's a lot of history there. It's a big hiker community, and there's the Appalachian Trail Conservancy headquarters is in Harpers Ferry as well. So they have a whole thing set up for you. They welcome you in, and then they take your picture at the headquarters. So it's this big thing, and that's why they call it the spiritual halfway point. Also, because every year the Appalachian Trail changes in length, so they have to pick one spot that's going to be always like the halfway point spot where, you know, physically it kind of changes every year. So that's why it's called the spiritual halfway point.
How does it physically change every year? Is it due to like trail rerouting or?
Exactly. Yep. They reroute it based on like what land is available, what land can be used for the trail. Also when parts of the trail get damaged or when they want to revegetate parts of the trail, things like that, they will reroute. And in the case of reroutes, more miles are added on and other miles are taken away. So, for example, this year we have 2,190 miles. And I think a few years ago it was 2,090 miles. So it really changes depending on the year.
Okay. So when was your physical halfway point on mileage that way? I know you hit 1,000 miles as well, but what was your mathematical halfway?
I believe we hit the physical halfway point 2 days ago. And we actually walked right past the actual spot where this year is the physical halfway point. We were not paying attention, I guess, enough to recognize the spot where they marked, hey guys, you've made it halfway. So we walked right past it, and we ended up taking our pictures at a sign that says, hey, you're halfway, but it wasn't really this year's halfway. It was a halfway point of a few years ago. So we took our picture there instead.
Well, you know, it seems like, as you mentioned, the Harpers Ferry was, you know, the big to-do and the big congratulations, you're almost, you know, you're making progress. So what was it like for you and Risha to reach Harpers Ferry? You know, did you feel a definite sense of lightness and accomplishment because it was, you know, a big deal for all hikers to pass through there?
It was a huge day for us. Personally, I was just elated all day. I was just so excited, in such a good mood. And it's such a beautiful place, Harpers Ferry, that it's kind of hard not to be excited because you walk up and the first thing you see is the Shenandoah River, and it's just gorgeous. There's all these rocks in the middle, like these big rocks, and then there's a beautiful view with mountains on both sides. And, you know, then you walk up and then you cross this bridge, and then we get into the town, and it's gorgeous. Everything is kept up so nice. They have a lot of pride in their town, and a lot of history and you kind of walk through the historical parts of the town, it takes you on a walking tour, basically, and the trail is part of the walking tour. So you get to read the signs about the buildings that were a part of the Civil War, and Harper's Ferry was a big divide between the North and the South. So it's just, it's got a lot of history there.
Right. So did it, I mean, halfway there, you've done a lot of miles, you've had a lot of nights on the trail, both good and bad, and various weather and climates. So did hitting that point help with your mental mindset? Did it reinforce, you know, the reason why you're doing this and give you some extra fuel? Or did you find it's been kind of up and down with that?
I would definitely say that hitting Harper's Ferry was a big mental boost for me. I was kind of struggling in the weeks before hitting Harper's Ferry. And once we got there, it was like, okay, we've done over 1,000 miles, and that's quite an accomplishment. Like, I just felt proud of myself and, you know, proud of us for doing this together. Plus just being in that town, there's a really good vibe there. And then being able to, just as we were getting out of Harper's Ferry, we got to see my mom and her boyfriend, and it was just a really nice way to hit the halfway point. And ever since then, it's been a lot better mentally, just kind of like starting again. We're done with the first half, now start the second half, you know.
Mm-hmm. What kind of difficulties were you having before you hit that point
mentally?
Yeah,
well, the trail gets monotonous, you know, like it's day after day, you're doing the same thing. You're getting up, you're packing up camp, and then you're walking a good number of miles, and then you're getting in and setting up camp, and, you know, it's the same thing every day. And coming into Harper's Ferry, we had done a lot of really long days where we were leaving early and getting in late, and it kind of gets to you sometimes. Well, it got to me, at least. And I guess the milestones are a really good thing to hang on to, because otherwise it's just day after day after day after day of hiking, camping, hiking, camping, hiking, camping, you know? So, like, holding on to the milestones of, oh, we hit 1,000 miles. Oh, we hit halfway. Oh, we hit 100 days on the trail, which we recently hit as well. So these are all big, you know, ways to just mentally feel really encouraged to keep going. You know, they're a really good checkpoint.
Yeah. Did you have any other tools in that day-to-day monotony that either you've learned on your own or have taken advice from other hikers on how to kind of break up that monotony or to at least view it in a little bit of a different perspective?
Well, animal sightings are really exciting for breaking up the monotony. That's always kind of like, just get you moving, get your blood pumping, you know, that kind of exciting. Adrenaline, yeah, get your adrenaline pumping. So animal sightings are great. But another more human thing, I mean, we are human, and we're human in this time period, is listening to podcasts. Like, I've been listening to, or music, but I've been listening to a lot of podcasts lately, and it's helped me mentally just kind of, you know, not every day you're going to feel the best and the most in tune with nature. And it's an adventure, but it's a long adventure. So not every moment of every day are you going to feel incredibly grateful to be there. And going into a podcast sometimes is a really good way to just kind of tune out for a little bit. A lot of people believe that it's totally wrong to do that. A lot of people on the trail do, but everyone hikes their hike the way that they want to. And I think listening to the podcasts are a really great way to just kind of tune out for a little bit and just get your miles in.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the animal sightings. What in particular have you encountered?
Well, we've seen 4 bears now. So this is really exciting. We waited, boy, almost 3 months to see a bear, and finally saw one just before we hit the Shenandoahs. And then we saw 3 more in the Shenandoahs, and they were pretty good sightings, like very close and not terrifying.
Yeah,
so,
you found it.
The perfect kind of sighting.
Definitely. Well, because I imagine you read about bear sightings in preparation of what to do, how to scare away a bear, or how to not approach a bear, give respect to various animals that you might encounter on the trail. So did you find yourself naturally coming back to these tips, or were you taken aback at first encounter, you know, on your very first bear to, okay, what's the safe thing to do? What's the protocol? What was that feeling like to see something like that up close? Because we have them in Wisconsin, but it's not super common.
Sure. Yeah, I've never seen a bear in Wisconsin, although I've heard they are up north. But Risa and I have seen, we've had bear sightings in California when we visited Sequoia National Park. So we've seen bears before, and we had really researched before we went to Sequoia, and we were prepared. And the funny thing is, though, in Sequoia, they were a lot smaller than they are on the Appalachian Trail. For some reason, they are just really massive on the Appalachian Trail. But we really handled ourselves. I didn't feel scared or anything. I just felt excited, but also very respectful of what that animal is. And it's a wild animal, you know? And we just practice what we know how to do, which is make sure the bear knows you're there, make a lot of noise, stretch out as big as you can, wave around your trekking poles. Apparently, they don't have good eyesight, so you want them to know that you're a big presence, and hopefully they catch your scent and they, you know, become aware of what you are, and then they will know well enough to turn the other way and walk away, which all of them did eventually do.
Now, with other smaller animals, now that it's summertime out on the trail, are the ticks and mosquitoes and flies and other insects, are those really getting bad?
Oh, they're awful. They are awful. The mosquitoes, especially in the last 2 or 3 days, have been the worst on the trail. And it's funny because last year in Wisconsin, Risa and I were on the Ice Age Trail in Kettle Moraine State Forest, and we were battling mosquitoes on the 4th of July last year. So I've made that link in my head when we were hiking and thinking, oh boy, the mosquitoes are really bad. And so apparently, it's like that anywhere.
Yeah, so with it being hotter, I imagine you're not wearing long sleeves and stuff as much as well. So how do you try and combat all the insects that are trying to get at your skin?
Well, actually, we are wearing long sleeves and long pants and have been since day one. And a lot of people don't understand or, you know, they think we're a little crazy, but this is our method for keeping insects away, especially ticks, because we have chosen we would not like to treat our clothes or use any chemicals on our skin like insect repellent. We have some natural insect repellent that we use, but that's the only thing we use. We do long pants and long sleeve shirts every single day, and we just deal with it.
Yeah, and carry on. So I imagine with the bugs and everything, that's one aspect of physically suffering. But have there been any other major physical breakdowns or times where you thought, you know, could seriously impact your mileage?
Let's see. Mostly it's like minor foot issues for both of us. I think most of it is like when I get bitten up on my feet and then I'm itching and like I tear open my feet or something, and then that rubs when I'm walking, and then it becomes really painful, and I have to dress those wounds and try and keep them from rubbing. Otherwise, it's mostly like swollen feet type issues and stuff like that. Risha has issues with getting little stones in her socks and then rubbing on the bottom of her feet, and then that rubs really raw. So trying to figure out ways to keep stones out of her shoes is her issue. Other than that, we've been holding up pretty well.
That's good to hear. Virginia takes up a lot of the trail, and, you know, you've been in that state for a long time, including the Shenandoah National Park, if I assume correctly, is in Virginia as well. So what is that state like to encompass so much of the trail?
Well, it's beautiful. I'll start by saying it is a beautiful state. We really enjoyed Virginia, and we've heard mixed reviews about Virginia, but mostly that people get the Virginia blues because it's such a long state. It's a quarter of the entire trail. You're in one state, and there's 14 states on the entire trail. So you can kind of get an idea of how much of the trail it takes up. You're popping in and out of the other states in days or weeks, and you're in Virginia for like a month and a half. So that was a long time, and a lot of people say it gets really monotonous and they get the Virginia blues, but we didn't really. We really enjoyed it. It was beautiful and a lot of really nice views and interesting walking, some flat, some pretty mountainous. And then we got to do the Shenandoahs, which were amazing. That was just such an amazing time in the Shenandoah National Park. They really do a nice job in there of welcoming hikers and having really great stops along the way.
I imagine that perhaps before the halfway point, a lot of people drop out. Do you know of any other hikers that you've met and made friends with along the way that have not continued on the trail?
We have had a couple of friends not continue their hike. One in particular we were incredibly bummed about because we had been hiking pretty much alongside her since almost the beginning of the trail, and we didn't expect her to drop out. So we were really sad about that, but she had an injury that took her off the trail, and she's hoping to heal up and get back on the trail in August and hopefully at least get to the halfway point. And that will be a really good accomplishment for her. But I don't think we'll see her again. So it's really sad to make a friend or make a few friends and then find out that they are getting off the trail for whatever reasons.
How does that make you feel in your journey and carrying on into the trail? Does it, you know, refuel your gusto to complete it? Or, you know, does it make you reflect and think, like, why am I doing this for months on end?
Well, I've never once on this trail thought, I'm not going to make it. So for some reason, I've always had this will to want to finish it and haven't been in a situation where I'm ready to quit. So whether everyone around me quits or they don't, or they stay on the trail, it doesn't really affect me. It's just sad to lose a friend off the trail. But I'm totally respectful. Everyone has their own reasoning for completing or not completing the hike. And either way, it's an amazing experience.
Well, and so far, having been past the physical and the spiritual halfway point, what new affirmations do you have in mind to carry forward?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, just I'm enjoying myself and I'm feeling a really good sense of starting again and, you know, getting a chance to start the second part of the hike, and I'm enjoying it, and I guess I don't have any new like plans or anything. It's still the same. I'm going to get to Mount Katahdin in Maine, and that's been the plan since the beginning, so still planning on doing it, and it's all going really well.
Well, I admire your consistency and gusto, and I wish you the best of luck until our next check-in point.
Thanks very much, Audrey, for having me.
Milwaukeean Lauren Groh is hiking the Appalachian Trail from Georgia north to Maine this summer. She's sharing her journey with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and the rest of us, and you can follow along and hear her past dispatches at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then we'll remember actor Martin Landau. He died over the weekend. We will revisit our interview with him from a few years back when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Martin Landau died on Saturday. The actor, who won an Oscar for his role in Tim Burton's Ed Wood, was 89. Landau was a journeyman actor whose career spanned parts of seven decades and included credits ranging from TV's Mission Impossible to Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest.
He only ever acted once in Milwaukee in a touring production of Paddy Chayefsky's Middle of the Night in the 1950s. But in 2009, he was an honored guest at the Milwaukee Film Festival, speaking at the Oriental Theater.
We caught up with him then at his hotel room at the Pfister, and he talked about his professional life, which began, interestingly enough, as a newspaper cartoonist.
I worked for the New York Daily News as a kid, and I was being groomed to be the theatrical caricaturist. An older man, an English fellow called Horace Knight, was retiring, and I was going to step into that job, which was a great job for a newspaper artist. I mean, I'd go to opening nights and the PR people would give me 8x10 photographs and I'd do a drawing of the cast for a Sunday paper. And if there were two openings, two. And that was my friend Bill Gallo, who does the sports cartoon, still at the news. He's 86 years, 87 now, I think, is still doing it. He's the last of the Mohicans. I mean, but we were there together back in prehistoric times. And I knew if I got that job, I'd never leave, so I quit. Much to the joy of my family. You know, you did what? So, I mean, I was pretty good at caricaturing people and stuff. But I quit because I did want to act, and it was totally illogical and stupid, you know, and everybody thought I was insane. I remember telling one person that I was going into the theater, and he thought I got a job as an usher at the music hall. So I knew that if I told them I wanted to quit, that they would, I'd have a barrage of objections. And so I quit before I told anybody. And it was, you know, fait accompli.
When you made the shift, you went into some amazing company in the 50s with Lee Strasberg, the Actor's Studio. It must have been an amazing time.
It was an amazing time. And New York in those days was an amazing place. I mean, I could actually walk across Central Park at night without looking behind me. Getting into the Actor's Studio was one thing. I had already done Summer Stock and several, you know, I did 12 shows in 13 weeks in my first Summer Stock musical, a straight play. I was singing. That came back and studied seriously with, you know, some very good teachers. But at the end of it all, the dream was to get into the studio at that point. And they didn't take a lot of people every year. I mean, lots of the year I auditioned, 2000 auditioned, and Steve McQueen and I were the only two accepted that whole year. You know, Dustin Hoffman swears that he did 9 auditions. The truth is, he did 6 auditions before he got in. Geraldine Page did 6 auditions. Gene Hackman 4 times. Bobby Duvall 3 or 4 times. I got in on my first audition.
It just makes me think about the effect that method acting has had on a generation, number of generations
of
actors.
It's changed the face of acting worldwide. It started with the group theater. And then, of course, the Royal Court Group in England, too, I mean, you know, picked up on that because there was a lot of very presentational acting done in England for a long time. And then when Tony Richardson's entire group, you know, with the Albert Finney and all of those, you know, Robert Stevens, Tom Courtenay, and Osborne's writing, you know, Osborne was basically Odets in the 30s, who was an actor with the group theater, started writing these plays, you know, Golden Boy, Rocket to the Moon. The same thing happened in England with Osborne, who was an actor with that company, and started, you know, writing the Angry Young Men plays, Look Back in Anger and Epitaph of George Dylan, and those plays, which changed the shape of English theater, too. So the group theater, the Actor's Studio, and, you know, all of which stems from initially Stanislavski and the quote-unquote method, which was Basil Trey. He actually called it the Stanislavski system in Russia. So I'm really not a method actor, I'm a system actor.
You're part of the system.
That's right.
Well, your career, we've talked about it a little bit. You know, you've ranged from everything from stage work to television work to Oscar-winning film performances. I have to say, Ed Wood, your part as Bela Lugosi remains one of my favorite things you've ever done. I can watch it over and over and over.
I love that. And Tim, working with Tim and Johnny was just joyful.
Beautifully made film, too.
It is, and Chapsky, the cinematographer, had never shot a black and white film before that. In fact, the first tests we did were in color. And then Tim actually was going to do the movie at Columbia, and Mark Canton, who was running Columbia at the time, said no to a black and white film. So he moved it to Disney. Tim calls me and says, you know, we've got a start date and this and that. I'm going to have to put the film off a month, because we're going to Disney with it, because they'll let me do what I want. Are you still on board? I said, of course, you know, but it, you know, we started a month later because of that. And I'd never met Tim before, nor Johnny before, and we got along wonderfully. And actually, I mean, Tim, it was sort of crazy how that happened, because I'd seen Beetlejuice and, you know, Edward Scissorhands, and I remember saying to my daughter, because I took her to see Beetlejuice, after we left, I said, yeah, I'd like to work with that guy. I mean, you know, I said, who the hell makes a movie like this? He's got a nut, but I like nuts. And several years went by, and then one day I get a call, and I on the phone says, oh, this is Tim Burton. I said, this is Thomas Jefferson. You know, I mean, I think, I mean, you know, I think it's someone, one of my friends was futzing around. And he said, I'm sending a script, check it out and get back to me. Here's my number at the studio and here's my number at home. I said, sure, Tim, you know, very cavalier. You know, I mean, usually it's an agent or an assistant or somebody's calling, but bingo, a guy gets on the phone and says, I'm Tim Burton. Well, sure enough, a script came, and then I read it, and I said, this is wonderfully nuts. And so I called a studio, and I said, well, Mr. Burton has gone home. I said, oh, okay. And then I call his home, and he picks up the phone. He says, what do you think? I said, I love it. He said, well, come in tomorrow, we'll talk about it. And I went in, and he said something very peculiar. He said, I'm supposed to do this picture with Julia Roberts, but I got this script, and Johnny and I talked about it, and if you do this movie, we'll do this movie and not the other movie. He said, I want you to play Bela Lugosi. I said, okay. And he said, and if you don't want to do it, then I'll do the other movie. We won't do this movie. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I don't know anyone else who can do it. And I said, I remember saying, there's 100,000 actors in SAG. What are you talking about? He said, I don't know anyone else who can do it. I said, I'm not sure I can do it. I said, you've written a 74-year-old Hungarian morphine addict alcoholic who has mood swings, which would be interesting and hard enough, but he has to be Bela Lugosi? Give me a break and go into any video store. You know, 20 years ago, maybe it would, you know, you have to stay up till 2 in the morning to one of those channels to see a horror film. But now you can go into any video store and pick up, you know, horror section, Lugosi, Lugosi, Lugosi. Anyway, we did a series of tests, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we won't go through all of that. But then we did the movie, and he didn't do the other movie.
And I'm very pleased that he didn't.
I'm more than pleased.
Yeah.
Because I had no chance of being in that Julia Roberts movie. You know, unless I played a never mind.
Yeah, something that you probably didn't want to play.
Well, no, there was no part in it for me. And in fact, it was almost all English, with the exception of Julia Roberts. All of those people talked like this. Upper class, you know.
You do that quite well.
Well, it's all right. You know, I talk all kinds of stuff like this. I do.
Do you do imitations,
too?
Well, that's
no,
great.
I just, you know. I mean, all the, you know, I come from New York, and all the Irish guys that go up would talk like this. Hey, Marty, there's a dance over here. And the Italian guys talk different. Hey, well, you come here, I want to ask you something. Stay the heck out of this, huh? Behave yourself. Otherwise, you know, hey, we don't want to hurt you. What are you laughing?
How about the Jewish guys?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, I knew those guys. I mean, there are a lot of Jewish guys, a lot of You look at my graduation picture from elementary school, it looks like the United Nations. I mean, literally, I mean, it's astonishing.
How has Hollywood changed for actors with all of this advent of technology?
Well, I mean, a character-driven script is still a character-driven script. And it's, you know, it's harder and harder to make a character-driven movie because of opening weekends and box office and the, you know, unless it has a lot of fireballs and a guy climbing and hanging off the side of a building or car chases and costs $200 million and opens to $60 million, it's harder and harder to get those studios to make those small movies. Around Oscar time, there's a handful of them that manage to get nominated, but for every one of those, I mean, you know, so many of them slip through the cracks that are really good films because they're not picked up and they're not distributed because they're not interested. They're interested, you know, the guys who are running the show these days are guys who are lawyers, agents, you know, guys who come a different way. They're not literate in the sense of the longest thing they've read is a deal memorandum, contract. They probably haven't read that, you know. No one reads anything anymore, you know, and scripts are about, you know, what's on the page and how you take it and liven it, you know. Novels are very different than scripts, you know, they're very descriptive. Scripts are basically all some description, a little bit, and then what people say. And terrible scripts are written all the time. I mean, you know, people always say, you know, I mean, what a character says to another character is what he's wishing to reveal or share with another character. Then the 90% he isn't willing to is what I do for a living. I mean, you know, people don't walk into a room and say, hello, everybody, what a wonderful party. I'm totally embarrassed because I don't know anybody here, you know. I mean, that's bad writing, and that's what you'll see, in essence, in a lot of films these days.
Do you still get nervous when films screen?
Less and less over the years. I've gotten used to that guy up there, and an ever-changing guy up there. Who's that old fart? That's me. Holy God. What happened to that dark-haired guy who jumped around? You know, it's when you pass a store window and you know, oh, God. You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of glass around. I see, oh, that's me. Anyway, no, but it's, you know, the wonderful thing about, you know, I mean, I'm in a line of work that allows me to keep going, you know. I mean, think about it. If I was a ballet dancer, I'd be watching a lot of ballets. And if I was an opera singer, I'd be listening to a lot of CDs. But I'm an actor, and I'm able to still act. And as I've gotten older, I'm playing older and older and older characters. And recently, I was called in by a director who remained nameless, and we talked. And she said, you know, I really want a 90-year-old actor for this. She said, I know you can do that. I said, well, then you called me in to tell me I'm wrong for the part. I said, why? She said, well, I just want you to know that I really like your work. And if I can't find a 90-year-old, you'll play the part. I said, you're basically calling me in to tell me I'm not going to get the part, that I'm not right. She said, well, I don't know how many 90-year-old actors. I said, you know, it's hard for me to play younger, but I could play older. I mean, I can get very old, very quickly, very old. Watch this. Anyway, so...
I wish our audience could see what you did with your body when you did that.
Radio, I grew up on radio, and the pictures that I drew in my head are probably why I'm here today, because radio was wonderful in that you had to cast it. You know, when I met Les Tremaine, and when I did North by Northwest, he was doing all these leading men on radio, and he was, and I looked at him, I said, this was the hero I grew up with. I had a whole other picture of a guy. Les Tremaine didn't look like any of the characters he played. When Jack Armstrong went into the Elephant's Graveyard and saw all that ivory, I saw, you know, that would have been a $2 million production just getting those elephant bones in that one space. No, but I mean, all in my head. So, I mean, part of wanting to be an actor, I think, was encouraged by radio. In that you really, when Orson Welles played The Shadow, I mean, it wasn't Orson Welles, it was Lamont Cranston, who had the ability to be invisible. And radio insisted that he be invisible, but I made him my guy and my invisible guy. And that you know, every kid on the block had a different picture. And it was your personal picture. So you were busy visually creating movies in your head, which is, I think, helpful in an odd way to filmmaking. Sometimes you see something and it's so flat, you know, it doesn't interest you. But if you describe something on radio, that is the tallest structure man has ever made. Wow, what is it? A tower. You suddenly become an architect and build a building that is unusual, and it's yours. And I think that's a very rich thing. You know, otherwise you see some terrible film, you know, with blood splattering on the walls, and you don't want to see it, you know. It's better to hear, oh, ah, God, oh, oh, ah. You make your own fight.
They're going to think I beat you up.
It's all right. Take your hand away. Stop that.
Well, Martin Landau, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
We spoke with actor Martin Landau in 2009 when he was in town as a featured guest of the Milwaukee Film Festival. The Academy Award winner died this past Saturday. He was 89. We leave you then with some music from Ed Wood, the film for which Martin Landau won the only Oscar of his long career. I'm Mitch Stein.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow morning and tomorrow evening at 10 for Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.